Today is Wednesday. It's August 18th, 2021 at 1:37 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record now on Wednesdays and will perform live for you October 30th at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove. Tickets go on sale soon. We'll keep you posted.
This is John Hansen. Oh, I interrupted you again, John. You took such a dramatic pause after that. I'm sorry.
No, it's because I was calibrating. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
You got to stop putting me second. I'm John Hansen. I host a WGN Radio on Saturdays and host of It's All Good, Block Club Chicago podcast. And Downers Grove is my hometown, so yay Tivoli Theater.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute. Strong endorsement for Every Day's a Sunday in downtown Downers Grove. It's a good pun-related ice cream place.
And I'm Heather Sharone with WTTW News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the feisty pundit at large.
Well, wow, Eric, I don't have a lot to work with there. Shall we just dive in?
I don't know if you could say feisty any less feisty than you just
did. Well, let me explain. I was discussing politics with my wife, and I said that I admire Susana Mendoza. And I said, yeah, like, she's kind of feisty. And she said, wait a minute. You would never call a man feisty, would you? And I said, well, yes, I would. And so I have to commit to calling myself feisty from now on, I guess.
It is one of those words that sets my teeth on edge.
Yeah, see? So I'm trying to rehabilitate feisty.
Were you a sportscaster in this town, you'd be out of work right now.
Right, I'd be canceled. But
although, what was the phrase that Gian Greco used?
Ditzy, I think, wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah.
It's a lot worse than feisty.
I will say this: the Biden presidency isn't so boring anymore. Taliban forces raced through Afghanistan this week, stormed the capital city. A citizen stormed the central airport. Taliban says that they are in charge, but don't worry, women and the media and U.S.-friendly translators are all going to be treated fairly and well. The video of Afghanis running alongside a massive U.S. C-17 cargo plane were exactly what President Biden promised earlier this summer we would not have. Scenes reminiscent of the fall of Saigon. Thousands of U.S. troops are arriving to bolster our evacuation forces. And today, one evacuation flight per hour is supposed to be taking off from Kabul, hopefully with no one clinging to the outside. So the question today is, what is next?
Well, I agree with just about everyone who thinks that our time was up in Afghanistan and it was time to leave. And it also seems like this was just a huge failure of planning for this withdrawal, that Biden could not have been more wrong when he said that it was going to go smoothly and we weren't going to see scenes like we saw in Saigon. Arguably, the scenes of people falling from those airplanes to their death is worse than what we saw in Saigon. And it just makes me wonder about what kind of intelligence we had, how quickly Kabul fell, how quickly the whole country fell, and that we just weren't ready for that. And I don't know if they're going to be able to fix the situation by sending more troops in to help ease this transition, but there are already a lot of American allies, the Afghan people who helped us, who are stuck in the city, who can't get to the airport because of the roadblocks the Taliban have set up. This was a disaster. I think it's a humanitarian disaster, and it's going to be a political disaster for Biden. So I can't make very many excuses for him.
I think the intelligence thing is absolutely correct, a lack of intelligence, but that also underscores a reason to get out. We have never had great intelligence in Afghanistan and understood how Afghans would react to certain things. I'll push back a little bit on the withdrawal. Obviously, an unmitigated disaster. When you look at what's happened, there's no other way around it. But people have been saying, why didn't they slowly evacuate people? And most intelligence, although saying what we just said, I don't know how high of a pedestal to put this on, said that as soon as you start withdrawing people, even in minimal amounts, it would have created a similar rush at the airport. That as soon as you started that evacuation, it was going to be a signal that we had lost trust in what was happening and something like that would happen. Now, what actually the videos that we see are just so striking, but Yeah, an unmitigated disaster.
What was a surprise to me was that I really didn't realize that the Trump administration's agreement or deal with the Taliban was inked at the end of February in 2020. And so it was the same week that it was the Super Tuesday Democratic primaries. And of course, we were all sort of beginning to realize that COVID was about to change our lives significantly. And I went back and I read some of those articles. And the terms of those deal made it clear that it was sort of a two-stage process. And the first stage was a military withdrawal, which is what we saw with Bagram Air Base closing and sort of the handover to the Afghan army. I'm just, you know, still at this point, not clear sort of whether that plan was poorly thought out and that President Biden should have scrapped that plan in total, or whether Biden erred by following that plan, or if he changed it significantly. And I just don't know the answer to that.
I've had two thoughts in my head, probably similar to Eric. One is that it was important that the United States got out of Afghanistan. There's never been a plan there for success. There never was going to be a plan for success. And Biden, to his credit, actually bit the bullet and got the U.S. out of Afghanistan. Second is the profound failure of how that was done, particularly to the brave Afghan people who helped the United States with the promise that they would later have a benefit from that. And the United States made a promise to those people and has broken that promise. So there were 20 years of failure, I think, capped off by an enormous slap in the face to all of those people. And that reputation carries. That's not like in a vacuum. When the United States makes promises to its allies in other places, that's affected by the fact that its promise was broken to so many of these people. Some of the messages that you've seen come out of the United States to those folks about reapplying for visas and things of that nature makes the Illinois Department of Employment Security look like the efficiency of a Chick-fil-A. Like that sort of bureaucratic failure was maybe one of the most offensive things about how this was done.
Well, it was interesting how Biden doubled down on blaming the Afghan people and the Afghan army in this speech the other day. Was it Monday? Where he came out and he essentially wagged his finger at the Afghan army. And it's true that one of the images that I've heard people use with this story is training wheels. Like, we had put training wheels on the Afghan army and we had tried to get them to ride the bicycle. And then as soon as the training wheels came off, the bicycle fell over. I mean, it was just, and it does underscore exactly what we're talking about, that this would have been, we could have put another 20 years in and this would have happened just as precipitously. But there is this long-term metastatic damage that you can see to the United States reputation around the world, and also quite likely to Biden's reputation as a foreign policy savant. I mean, he was a guy who had all this experience, and he was on the committees and the Senate and everything, and he was the one who was supposed to surround himself with really highly competent people. And this wasn't this crazy, you know, from the gut kind of dealing with problems that the Trump administration always exhibited. And yet you had this situation where, well, how many weeks ago was it where Biden said this is not going to be like the fall of Saigon? And it's turned out to be in many ways worse.
The image or the video of watching those people fall from that airplane gave me a reaction, a feeling inside that I haven't felt since watching jumpers from the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
And not only because of, you know, falling through the air, obviously, but that was their alternative. That was their own. Of course, you're going to die if you're holding on to a giant airplane about to. But that's better than what you're leaving behind, similar to the jumpers out of the towers. I just, ugh.
Heather's point about blame, I think, is important. And the point that when Biden was really insulting the remaining Afghan forces there for a problem that is caused by the United States over 20 right. years, those people were trained to fight alongside U.S. forces, specifically air power. And when the U.S. removed air power, who's going to be the last person to fight for a dying cause? And to then pile on top of that, the people who had helped you in that region, I thought was a really low blow. Similarly, Congress and their complete abdication of responsibility over 20 years, and the fact that an executive was basically allowed to continue this war on and on and on, And of course, that Trump deal, which the Taliban violated, pretty shortly thereafter, and I think the U.S. should have pulled out as well. So it's not just Biden; it's failures at all levels.
The rare instance I noticed of somebody, the press describing the Trump-Biden policy. Trump didn't do us any favors, and Biden didn't do us any favors either here. It's the one time they've been in concert on something, and it is this. I talked to Greg Jaffe, the reporter for The Washington Post, who follows this area a little bit, and he said the notion that they cut and run the Afghani soldiers, he said, is unfair. He said 60,000 of them paid with their life, and maybe, Austin, that was the difference, that the means by which they were planning on fighting is gone now. And it's not like they were cowards or not willing to fight for something, although you do kind of wonder what they're fighting for.
It's important to note, like, yes, it's inevitable that there's going to be turmoil in the region and likely the Taliban's going to take control over the country again, right? Like, over, and that was part of Biden's speech that I think made the most sense. We did this 10 years earlier, 10 years later, have been the same result. But the speed at which that takes place varies a lot. And when the Soviets got out of Afghanistan in the 80s, it took 3 years for the Taliban to really take power back. And we saw it in a matter of days. And that's a huge difference. And Eric's point about it being worse than Saigon is well taken. And this was self-inflicted, which makes it worse.
The Taliban didn't really exist until the 90s. So it wasn't a transition from Soviet-controlled Afghanistan to the Taliban. And I think that's an important distinction. The other thing is, I also think it's important to know that Trump wanted all of our American forces to be out by May 1st of this year. And Biden pushed that deadline back, saying it should be September 11th, because he said he was trying to ensure an orderly transition of power. And I think that one of the things that the Biden administration wrongly didn't anticipate was that the president of Afghanistan was going to pack a whole bunch of bags of money and flee the country. And we learned today that he's in the United Arab Emirates. So, like I said, there's plenty of blame to go around. And certainly Trump also said that he favored a complete withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. I question, and I think there's ample evidence to suggest that the Trump administration would not have been any more competent in doing this than the Biden administration. There's no evidence to suggest that. Yeah. And the second question is was this a failure of planning, or was it a failure of intelligence? Did the administration just not plan for the worst case scenario, or was the administration told by the military, by the CIA, that things weren't going to get this bad and such plans were not necessary? I think there's a little bit of conflicting reporting on that right now, and I will be interested to see sort of how all that shakes out.
Or maybe a little bit of both. Some of the reporting I was reading was that they either didn't know, or what they knew was bad enough that they didn't want to say.
We were talking about these comparisons to Saigon. The one point I was going to make is, after Saigon, we took in 130,000 Vietnamese citizens into the United States, including in Iowa, a Republican governor, Robert Ray, who led the charge of bringing Vietnamese refugees to the United States. And here, how many? 20,000 maybe? And people are already pushing back on the right about allowing Afghan citizens the right to come to the United States. This categorically worse than the fall of Saigon.
There's a big Hmong community in Minnesota, in St. Paul and Minneapolis, as a result of accepting refugees. And you notice that Governor Pritzker was welcoming them to our great state. I thought it was interesting how he got in front of that. You know, I don't think there's much political gain, but he said, as the child of refugees himself, he would welcome them to Illinois.
Well, I think that the refugee question, I think, is a really interesting one politically, because so many of the Vietnamese refugees who ended up settling in places like Orange County, California, outside of Los Angeles, ended up being really reliable Republican voters. And I think that that just shows you that this is not sort of a clearly defined sort of outcome type situation. And I think that I found President Trump's statements through his press office yesterday very interesting, because he initially seemed to suggest that President Biden should have done a better job in ensuring that those who wanted to come to America after helping American forces were able to do so. so. And we saw a complete 180 from him after people on the right pushed back against that, using really just racist and xenophobic tropes. And then this morning today said that that refugees should not be allowed to come to America. So I think it's important to remember that it might seem like immigrant refugees would be predisposed to vote for the Democratic Party. But I think our experience, you know, after Vietnam shows that's very far from a sure thing.
Aren't you worried about the terrorism threat to the United States as a result of this? We talked to Congressman Krishnamurthy, and, you know, that is a concern. He was acrimonious, though. He was just, I don't know if he sounded angrier or sadder, but about the fate of the translators or the ill treatment they're getting from us, the translators in Afghanistan. But I think a lot of our listeners are just like, okay, I could ignore this if I didn't think we're now planting the seeds for another 9/11 down the road. I mean, what happens now, right? That's the scary part.
What are they saying, John, that some of these refugees from Afghanistan are going to tunnel into our country and commit terrorist acts? Is that the contention?
I think when you look at that picture of all of those people on that airplane, mostly men, by the way, people say, aha, who are those people? Are some terrorists embedded in there? Or are they going to turn? Who? We don't know who those people are. Where are they going to come? We don't want them.
Or that a vacuum of power or a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan will be a harbor for terrorists to grow in the future. I imagine that's a huge concern.
I think that's the overriding concern. But I think we also have to remember, like, terrorist attacks through time are essentially random, rare events. And the best way to prevent them is what we've been talking about, which is great intelligence and infiltrating terrorist cells, not occupying countries for 20 years. And I don't think you could say that, you know, bombing the hell out of Afghanistan as recently as 2017 to 2019 made America any safer. Those plots are foiled by great intelligence work rather than, you know, decades long boondoggles in remote parts of the world.
Well, do you feel safer today as you did last week?
Yeah.
You feel safer today. You think that actually...
No, I don't feel safer. I no change personally in my personal terrorism risk alert system,
sure.
Which is also a green, yellow, red system.
And you are in the same position today as you were last week.
Yeah, I'm still in the green.
Wow. John, are you?
Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not. I mean, well, good. You guys are real smart. So explain to me why I shouldn't worry that Al-Qaeda or ISIS or somebody isn't going to have more of a fertile ground there and it's not going to somehow come around and get us.
Well, as Austin said, 9/11 was largely due to a huge intelligence failure of communications between the FBI and different levels of the CIA. That, in fact, we had the pieces of the puzzle together, but we couldn't put them together. No one did. And I feel like our intelligence, well, although we've been talking about how poor it has been in Afghanistan in many ways, I trust the agencies better. Maybe that's really naive. John, maybe we're just really naive on this, but
intelligence is fine, but you guys are giving them the pieces of the puzzle. You're saying, okay, go make another terrorism puzzle. I'm like, no, how about we not create an environment where that terrorism is going to foment? Intelligence notwithstanding, hopefully the intelligence comes back and says that they didn't have a place to create these terrorists.
Well, then, John, where do you want to go? Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia? I mean, how many countries do you want to go in to give them a Western democracy, which never works anyways, to have a fail-safe proof way of
doing
this? I'm
not talking about converting them. I'm just saying don't you think that the U.S. presence was some measure of suppression for the creation of terror cells? I mean, we haven't had a 9/11 since 9/11, right? So I don't know. I'm looking at that going, holy crap. Here it comes.
We knew long before September 11th that Al-Qaeda was headquartered and had been given safe haven by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And before September 11th, there was no thought that that posed a threat to the United States or anybody living in the United States. After 9/11, that calculus is different. So if we see terrorist camps forming in Afghanistan with the protection of the Taliban, then that changes the, you know, calculus. One of the errors of September 11th was that hubris, was that sense of that nobody could ever touch us in America. And for better or for worse, that ended with 9/11. So no American president, I don't care if you're Republican, I don't care if you're GOP, I don't care if you are from an unnamed third party in the future, is going to allow terrorist camps to grow the way that Al-Qaeda grew in Afghanistan. I don't see our withdrawal from Afghanistan really anything different than it was before. The question is that will we have enough intelligence assets left in that part of the world to give us as much of a head, a heads up or a warning that we need? You know, that's an open question. And John is completely right that we had many opportunities to stop 9/11 from happening without sending thousands of American troops to a country far, far away. And I think that the calculus is unchanged.
I'm not sure that you need an entire country in order to plan a terrorist attack. That this idea that they needed the entire nation of Afghanistan in order to have basis for their terrorist activities. You saw Osama bin Laden living almost openly in Pakistan before he was killed, and they had their mountain hideaways and the kinds of things that they're planning. They're not getting together an army to attack the United States. They are looking for these kind of these small, extremely dangerous, extremely frightening acts of terror that doesn't require a whole bunch of real estate to plan those out. I think Heather is exactly right that what we're looking at here is much more intelligence and also security measures in our own country. I am amazed that it's been almost 20 years and we have not seen a repeat of 9/11. On 9/11 itself, I wouldn't have given you any odds that wouldn't have happened again. Remember, we were all opening our mail and worried that every envelope was going to have anthrax in it. And
of course, the anthrax attacks were not a foreign terrorist attack, you know?
Right.
The fear was there. I agree with all, you know, John, the only thing I will say is I feel like I believe what I said, but I could totally see you clipping this 3 minutes that all four of us have said, and we are going to look real dumb at some point.
Yeah, you guys just watch some future podcast. I'm going to burn you guys. Bad stuff happens. You'll be sorry.
Yeah.
An op-ed by Arne Duncan in the Tribune this week said that if we want to clamp down on the type of violence that took Officer Ella French's life 2 weeks ago, we need to invest more in blighted communities. Specifically, he said we need to reduce the incentive to steal or sell drugs, give them a reason to put down their guns and drugs, he said. Under an organization called Chicago Cred, and he's the founder of it, Arne Duncan is, these young, mostly men, would get stipends, training, counseling, and mentoring. This is his idea. It's not novel. Other cities have organizations like Chicago Cred, and it's not the only one like it in Chicago. Anyway, negotiators would broker peace treaties in neighborhoods. But here's the most interesting sentence, I think, from his op-ed in the Tribune. We estimate that taking these programs to scale would cost $400 to $500 million a year. One last thing about that. He reminds us that the Chicago Police Department budget is $1.7 billion. The cost of crime to Chicago comes to around $7 billion a year. So he wants to conceivably feed and employ every young man and woman at risk of shooting or being shot until we can get this thing under control and then maybe finally stem the tide. John Hansen, what's your reaction to all of that?
Oh, boy. I mean, it's like a lot of things. It sounds great. And I agree with the giving people opportunity, but some of these things, I mean, I do appreciate that it wasn't just generational stuff he was talking about. He's talking about getting your hands dirty and immediate impact things. But sure, where does that money come from? I don't know. I mean, I want to hear from Austin because I know you wrote your piece a couple of weeks ago, which I found fascinating, and kind of line up the two ideas.
Yeah, a lot of our conversation with Austin last week was about the police reform and government reform, Austin. What do you think about
that? Yeah, I just think that's the lowest hanging fruit, right? Like, there's tons of root causes like poverty and discrimination that affect crime. But if you're going to talk about a crime problem, like, start with policing and improving the governance of policing and the operations of the police department, if you care about crime. That said, I think it is really important as a city to invest in programs that work and have proven results. The problem is that Chicago is such a fiscal basket case that we have, you know, $43,000 in debt per Chicago taxpayer right now. And pensions have crowded out are the monster that's gobbling up money that's needed for critical social services. Yesterday's government is gobbling up those resources. So, and I don't think those two things are, those things need to be talked about in unison more. What do you want to prioritize in the budget? Do you want to get those obligations under control that are providing zero value to communities in Chicago today? You have to have trade-offs. You can't just say, let's make this money appear.
But I was also struck in Austin's piece a couple of weeks ago where he talked about the fact that when you look at Chicago's crime problem against, say, Los Angeles's crime problem or other big cities we compare it to, that those cities have the same problems that we do with dispossessed youth, people without jobs, poor schools, and so on. They've got the same problems they do. They do not have the murder problem that we do, the crime problem we do. So you need to look beyond this. I mean, I think it's manifestly obvious that what Arne Duncan says is true, that this is a crisis of opportunity for these young men, mostly, let's be honest, who are committing these crimes, and that you give them opportunities, you can reduce this crime rate. But the question is then, what do you do with the problem that's on top of that, which is our poor policing structure and our poor disciplinary structure and the lack of trust in the police department in the city, that this problem is not as isolated as maybe Duncan's op-ed makes us think.
Arne Duncan's op-ed, he's on everyone's short list to challenge Lightfoot in 2023. So I read that as his opening argument in that campaign. And what's interesting is that it comes from a progressive point of view that we have not heard articulated at any sort of level of detail from Mayor Lightfoot. And I am, you know, unconvinced that Arne Duncan is, a fully viable mayoral candidate. But if he were to become a fully viable mayoral candidate as a rich white dude, this is how he would do it, in sort of running against Lightfoot from her left, appealing to progressives who feel like the mayor has all but ignored and locked them out of discussions over violence. Because, you know, and just this week or last week, we heard the mayor said that, of course, she's going to propose an increase to that $1.7 billion police budget. I'm certain that Arne Duncan truly wants to reduce violence, but the politics also sort of, I think, are an important part of this as well.
I think that was really, I totally agree with Heather. And he raised a point that you wouldn't maybe normally think from a candidate like him, which was that Chicago already has more police than most other cities per capita, which people don't talk about very much when they're coming from, you know, his background and perspective. But that's really important to the resources question. Chicago does not have a lack of police personnel problem. It's an operations problem. And that comes down to better governance of the police department to improve.
Well, do you guys think that that position is politically smart? Suppose that's an opening salvo for a run for mayor. Are people going to love that? Or are they just going to roll their eyes and go, oh, really? Now we got to give them $500 million? Seriously, that's a good position to take?
It was the position that Lightfoot had during the mayoral campaign. It was also the position that Tony Preckwinkle had during the mayoral campaign. And they finished 1 and 2 in the first round of voting. Bill Daley, it seems like I'm talking about a foregone era of Chicago politics, and I sort of am. He was running as, we need more police officers, we need better enforcement, we need to send more people to jail for longer. That did not get him anywhere.
Do you think it's changed now, though, Heather? Has the environment changed?
I don't think so, because I think that you can point to Chicago's continuing problem with violence and say Chicago is having it worse because of our operations problems, like Austin said. Like, we know what to do. We have to do something different, but yet we've continued to do the same thing all the way around, and it's not made any difference. And Lightfoot very clearly promised a new approach, and I think you would be hard-pressed to sort of drill down to the nitty-gritty and show me how she's been different than Rahm Emanuel on these issues, because I don't think she really has been. I think she would agree with you. She thinks that the city is in a more place where there's need for more enforcement. I'm not convinced that that's true. And I think that her poll numbers show that she's in a little bit of trouble on that.
I think she was at 48. Now she's at 42% approval rating on her performance.
Yeah, this was a new WGN-TV Emerson College poll, and 46% of those polled disapprove of the job Lightfoot is doing, and about 42.5% approve. And this contrasts with in June, Lightfoot's approval rating was 48%. So it's dropped 2%, I guess, 48 to 46. And I don't know how significant that is, really. I mean, in terms of the margin of error, it seems like it's holding fairly steady. They also asked about Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, and her job approval number was 35%. Well, given that she just won re-election, it seems that was a surprising number for me. But I think people are very, very frustrated with the kind of crime they're seeing. We're seeing reports all the time of these gangs of robbers, I guess you call them, or thieves who are attacking people in the Loop, knocking them down. And they put a woman in the hospital the other day who didn't quickly enough surrender her cell phone. And people are understandably very dismayed about this. And there was an arrest the other night of a bunch of kids who were supposedly going around to convenience stores and doing this kind of stuff again near North and in the Loop. And charges weren't filed. They were back out on the street in a couple hours. And people I think we're setting the stage for a real tough on crime era. And the mayoral candidate who challenges Lightfoot in 2 years, in 2023, is going to be the one who is going to be definitely to her right on crime. And that, I think that's, in a way, Duncan is acknowledging the seriousness of the problem, and he's suggesting a solution. And the only problem with that solution, as we pointed out, is that it's, you know, $500 million, and we're already in debt. So we're in debt. So what was the budget shortfall in the recent budget? Was $733 million.
I think it's clear that I didn't read Arnie Duncan's op-ed as saying we need to spend $500 billion more in addition. Right. The $1.7 billion. If you want to tell me that there's $500 million in the Chicago Police Department budget that can be reallocated toward social services, I think most people would agree with you that there are. Considering, for example, that over the last 4 years, the city has spent somewhere close to $100 million alone on complying with the consent decree, it's clear that the money is there. I think it's a question of, does this budget speak to our values as a city, and is it allocated properly in terms of effectiveness?
Yeah, I don't know either. I'd like to see him sharpen his pencil and show us where he plans to come up with that half. I mean, it was a striking sentence, and John read it, and you can't just kind of go past that and go, okay, well, let's spend that money that way. Where does that money come from? I don't know if there's $500 million in the police budget. It's the police budget is what, 1.7 billion. So what's that's a third. So you're saying if you can cut the Chicago police budget by between a quarter and a third without harming public safety, or with the other enhancements, I mean, this is in effect, this is a way of saying, I mean, the defund the police argument is not that we should take money away from the police, but it's that we should reallocate the resources that are given to the police department. So this is a version of that argument, but it doesn't use that, what I consider to be a fairly toxic phrase, often misunderstood phrase, that you talk about redeploying the resources you have. If Heather's right that there really is $500 million in the
I'm not budget, I'm not saying that there is. I'm just saying that in a $1.7 billion budget that takes up 40% of the city's general fund, it's mathematically possible.
I'm shocked her number is that high. To be honest, I said this last time too. I don't know who. I know there are Mayor Lightfoot fans out there. I don't know which progressives are not happy More conservative folks aren't happy. I guess she rides that moderate line. I'd be willing to bet, John Williams, you want to go $100 that she doesn't win re-election.
Really?
Yeah. I maybe the runoff will be different because she'll probably be a top two candidate there. Like, I just don't see a world in which she wins again. But what do I know?
Kim Fox isn't going to win re-election, but Lori Lightfoot's a tougher guess.
Wait a minute.
But I thought Kim wasn't going to win last time.
Kim Fox just won re-election.
She just won re-election.
But it's even worse now.
And she won it going away.
Yes,
she did. The facts on the ground have not changed.
Okay, so wait. This is crazy, but do both, Heather. Kim Fox wins re-election, yes or no?
4 years from now? Are we all alive 4 years from now?
It would seem to me, sitting here today, that the probability of either of them getting re-elected in this century is worse for Kim Fox than it is for Lori Lightfoot, and that it's not good for either of them.
I think Kim Fox faced a much tougher challenge than Lori Lightfoot will face, simply because Kim Fox had to run in a partisan primary where she defeated not just a Democratic rival, but then she went on and defeated a Republican rival. Now, her Democratic rival had literally more money than God. Like, he was rolling in it. He came nowhere close to her. And the Republican Party in Illinois exists now only to support President Trump or to oppose President Trump, neither of which has anything to do with how the operation of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. So I think Lori Lightfoot faces a different path with different challenges, in that she's basically just got to win a majority of votes. And, there are going to be any number of challengers, but there will not be somebody running in the Chicago mayoral race saying proudly, "I am a Republican," the way that Kim Fox faced.
One of the things interesting to me is how Lightfoot won that election with something like 75% of the vote, as I recall, 74, 75. And so her approval rating drop off is precipitous. And the fact that it's under 50% after having won with such an amazing majority, I think speaks to the lack of patience that a lot of people have with the way she's running the city.
Heather, you want to start a wonky polls podcast with me?
Because yes, that is right on my alley. Yes.
I don't know if everyone else wants. I don't know if anyone would listen to it. But
we need more Chicago poll. We should do a Rascals push poll about stuff in Chicago. That would be interesting. Some kind of a pulse.
What would the question today be, Austin? We'll ask the people listening to email johnwilliams@wgnradio.com.
What do you want? I think we should do a John Williams job approval. But to go back to the budget and the political question really quickly. So Chicago's the budget numbers that came out, what was that? I guess last week, right? Those new budget numbers came out. We're talking about $500 million in the Duncan version of fixing the crime problem and the $1.7 billion police budget. The pension payments for the city jumped $430 million in 1 year. That's just the increase. It will be, by fiscal 2022, it will be more than $1 billion more in pension payments than ROM's last budget. That's the elephant in the room when it comes to the budget. And funny enough, the only mayoral candidate to really talk about that last go around was Daley, who said he was in favor of a pension constitutional amendment, and that cost him the police vote on the Southwest side. Those people all went out and sort of voted in protest for Joyce. So the political and the budget are very, very intertwined.
Let's talk just for a few minutes about where Chicago is in the COVID crisis, which seems to be back. It's kind of like the Karate Kid, mask off, mask on, now mask off. The 30 percenters have driven the infection numbers high enough that the city is imposing an indoor mask mandate, regardless of vax status, starting Friday.
For all people over the age of 2, regardless of your vaccination status, we're now getting, we're averaging 444 new cases a day. But Arwady also pointed out that hospitalization figures are relatively low. And they're still holding off on the idea of a vaccine mandate, like you're seeing at a number of institutions. I keep, John, through the week, I always text John when a new company or institution puts in a vaccine mandate, because I'm all about those.
Well, no, wait. No, you weren't. Last week you said you like the idea of vax mandates, but not from the government, but from individual businesses.
Yes, I like them from businesses. I think that's the way to start. If that doesn't work, then I'd have to reconsider my position. But I like the idea of restaurants, concert halls, employers all saying, look, you know, you don't get your, you know, the vaccine, do not darken our doors. That's my position on that. And if that works, then we don't have to have the government requiring it for everybody, which is not a great look.
What's the matter, John?
I'm pissed. I am so upset about this. I'll do it. I'm going to comply. I get it. I'm not mad at the official. I'm mad at unvaccinated people. I put an unofficial Twitter poll on my Twitter page, and 95% of people blame unvaccinated people. I'm the same way. I'd rather them mandate a vaccine requirement before they bring the mask requirement back again. I did my damn part. I did it. A lot of us did it. And I know it's not that annoying. And so people that say that I lose auction, I can't, whatever. I worked out at a gym for a year with a mask. I can do it again. But it is so darn annoying.
And unnecessary. I mean, it is such a self-inflicted wound.
And is it really? I mean, I'm not doubting the science of masks here. But a lot of people in the areas where I live are 70, 75, 80% vaccinated. We're not the problem. Why can it not just be a mask mandate for the unvaccinated? I know you can't prove that or unprove it, but the hospitalizations are still low. Like, that was supposed to be the metric that guided all of our decision making. A lot of cases are coming from non-symptomatic people that are vaccinated that will have very mild symptoms. Like, I'm really fired up about a return of this mask mandate, way more than I thought I would be.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to drag. I had to go to the closet. I had to like dig around in a box that I thought I was going to burn in my closet to go find the masks that we had. Yeah. And I put it on today and I was like, oh, God.
I will tell you that as a mom of two not fully vaccinated kids, is that it's really hard to hear government officials saying, okay, things are bad enough that we have to go back to wearing masks. But good news, it's totally safe for your unvaccinated kids to go back in school and only have 3 feet of social distancing. And trust me, it's going to be fine.
And on Wednesday morning, Jesse Sharkey, the president of the CTU, announced that they're at cross purposes with the Chicago Public Schools about their reopening plans. He feels that the safety measures they have in place don't go far enough.
In terms of the mask mandate, was there any, I didn't see this, which doesn't mean it doesn't necessarily exist. It's not like there was a trigger established for when masks would be required and not, correct?
Similar to cases, how, yeah, I think it was 400 cases a day they'd revisited, Heather. Was that it?
Or? I mean, so essentially, since the start of the pandemic, Chicago has had these three thresholds: 200 cases on average per day based on the 7-day rolling average, 400 cases per day, and then 800 cases per day. 800 cases per day is, things are way, way out of control.
The metrics are different, though, when you have so many people vaccinated.
And Delta versus...
So the problem COVID-19. Is, yes, it should be. If we were still living in a world where there was no Delta variant, I think you're right, John. I think that the metrics would be different because of the vaccination. But because the Delta variant, it seems to be more transmissible, so that you've got a greater level of cases in a given area, more vaccinated people are going to have breakthrough infections. The best way I've heard it described is like, so if it were a slow, steady rain of COVID and we had umbrellas, the vaccinated people had umbrellas, we wouldn't get wet. But this is a hard driving rain that comes sideways at you, that our umbrellas give us some protection, but they don't prevent us from getting wet. And that, I think, is the situation that we're in now.
They prevent us from drowning, right? I mean, that's the thing. The vaccine, and what I mean, I'm much more interested not in the case numbers so much as the hospitalization numbers and the death numbers, which seem to be still on the low side. And because that's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about myself, my loved ones, everybody else getting sick and going to the hospital or dying. If it's just going to be these sort of mild symptoms that vaccinated people get, I'm less concerned about this, and which is why I'm resonating quite a bit with John's frustration, which is like, look, I've gotten vaccinated, I've been careful, I'm not at a particular risk. I may get it, but it's like, you are really asking everybody to carry the weight for these people who refuse to get vaccinated because of some superstitious feeling they have about vaccines.
Eric, do you think that the students should all go back in person and masks are sufficient protection then for everybody?
I think that the science, or sorry, the studies on this are very clear that you want kids to be having in-person education, that remote education is not good enough. It's not what we need to have done.
No.
I would like to see them try, certainly. And I think, you know, masks, again, I think masks are a little overrated in terms of how much they can help, but they do help some. If they can keep distancing, if they can keep those things going, I think they should try. Yeah.
Shouldn't the incentive be for high schoolers to get vaccinated too? Couldn't we say that if you're vaccinated as a high schooler because you're eligible, that then you don't have to wear a mask? You don't have to wear it when you play football, basketball, whatever. That's why I think it shouldn't be mandated for students. I think it should be the same level of 12 and above.
Mandatory, John, for high school students, the vaccine to go to school, like some college?
No, they could wear a mask if they aren't. I just worry you move the goalposts too many times. No one listens to the refs anymore. So.
Well, here's where a lot of people are, I think, John, is that it's like the Eric umbrella analogy. You know, I might get a little wet, but I won't drown. And if you do, that's on you. As an adult, even your kids. You know what? I was at the Walmart the other day, and they were saying over the loudspeaker at Walmart, if anybody needs a vaccine, you can get vaccine right now. Just go to aisle 12. We'll give you a vax. Just come on in. And I know there are pharmacy deserts out there, but I think a lot of people are like, that's on you now, and too bad for your kids, but they're probably going to be fine anyway. And I'm not even being sarcastic here. I think that's sort of the attitude of most people, including John Hansen.
Yes.
And maybe including me a little bit. I mean, you know, I'm not the mayor. I don't have to make public policy, but I don't blame you if that's where your head is right now. I want to talk about speeding tickets for a minute, even though Lisa Donovan isn't here and she picked up one a week. But speeding tickets are becoming big generators for Chicago of revenue. Maybe not relative to the numbers the city looks at, big revenue generators, but they're getting a lot more money than they thought they were going to get. If you go 6 miles an hour over the speed limit now, they're just mailing out $35 tickets. Our traffic reporter, WGN, has picked up 6 in the last couple months. My general manager's picked up 2, each of them doing about 37 on Columbus Avenue, where they're supposed to be going 30. Nobody around them. They're not safe, unsafe, crazy people. Some of those cameras in some neighborhoods on the south side, but also northwest sides, are generating 1,000 tickets a week. They're just like, those things just can't make talk about printing money. They're just printing out $35 photographs like that. And then some people say, well, then don't speed. I just don't think that is I don't think that's fair.
And I think the extension of that logic is, okay, well, let's install them at every intersection. Like, there's no limiting principle to that, in my opinion. And the problem, you would call this in other places like Ferguson, policing for profit. It erodes trust in law enforcement. No, especially I can understand speed camera setup maybe for people going way over the limit. There are tons of people drive safely, but vast majority of people driving safely every day for going 6 miles an hour over the speed limit. And you're right, they're total cash machines. And there are trade-offs to doing this. It's not just about the safety effects, it's about how people interact with the city. And speaking of Lightfoot campaign promises, this was a massive one. We're not going to hit poor people with fines and fees that drive them into bankruptcy, particularly Black motorists in Chicago, which there's been tons of great reporting on. Yeah. This is only going to increase that. And it's not like she just let this happen, let this continue. It's been a mass proliferation of this program under her administration.
It's funny that they don't do it on Lakeshore Drive. Not that I think the city could, right? The city doesn't control LSD. That's the state.
I think you mean Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable Lakeshore Drive, John. But
I didn't have the time to fail that.
That's all the time we have. I mean, it does seem to me, I have not seen any studies that show that people going 6 miles an hour over the speed limit are any more risk to pedestrians or other motorists than people who are driving the speed limit, given that speed limits tend to be fairly conservative, especially where you place some of these speed cameras, which is they'll put them by parks and stuff where they're, you know, ostensibly there to protect children and people walking their dogs and so on. The people who are going 6 miles an hour over the speed limit are not threats to public safety, in my opinion and in my experience. As someone who tends to drive maybe 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit, certainly on the highways. And I think that Austin is exactly right, that it just makes people mad at government. It's most of the people who are getting these fines can afford them. It's $35, I believe, for that level of fine. Yep. It's not going to break them. It's not going to mean they can't pay their rent or make their car payments or send their kids to school. But it's a real annoyance, a real irritant. And you think, like, do better. The city needs to do better, find better ways to do revenue than to get people who are doing that. Because otherwise, yeah, you could set up these cameras at any stop sign in town and catch people rolling through stop signs when there's no one else around. It happens all the time.
These cameras are supposed to be near parks and schools, and that technically they are not allowed to ticket unless there is a child or pedestrian present. However, this was litigated when these cameras were installed by Rahm Emanuel. They were exceedingly unpopular by Rahm Emanuel. I know John and I worked on coverage of these cameras when they were installed at DNA Info, and some of them are just, you know, they stretch the boundaries. So if you're driving on Northwest Highway through Norwood Park, there's a camera that is ostensibly designed to protect students walking to Taft High School that is actually on the other side of a railroad track from school. So, there's also one on Cicero near Lawrence tied to a pocket park. And that's the one that you were mentioning, John, that hands out thousands of tickets every day because it is literally not visible from Cicero. So you as a driver would not think, oh, there's a park, maybe there's a kid nearby, I should, you know, make sure I am traveling below the speed limit. So, the cameras themselves were unpopular. The fact that we all sort of forgot about them and then Mayor Lightfoot reminded us about them, I think, is an interesting political decision.
I drive by one every day on Western Avenue near Lane Tech, and the drivers have learned it. We slow down, everyone comes to a crawl, and then we bolt to make the next light. So we're just passing the buck down to the next intersection. I mean, really, that's all that's happening.
And that's to the effect that these are effective, to the effect automated traffic enforcement is an effective tool. The city of Chicago has proven completely unable to use them in a way that's fair to anyone. We learned this with red light cameras, where they're shortening the yellow light times below the legally admissible range. We learned it with all of the bribes and kickbacks that happened with that program. Would not be surprised to see the exact same thing happening with speed cameras. The city can't be trusted to use this tool in a way that makes people safer, period.
Yeah. Well, you know, John, you remind me of, and I think I mentioned this a long time ago on this podcast, or maybe it was on the air, but the idea that you speed afterwards to make up for lost ground reminds me very much of what happened when I lived in LaGrange Park. And one night, a lot of us woke up to stop signs that had been put up, you know, in the last 24 hours, say, at intersections all around our neighborhood where there weren't. And they said, well, we got some pressure from parents who were worried about the kids, so we put up stop signs to slow everybody down. And at the town meeting that happened later, an engineer, traffic engineer, said, we can prove it to you. We'll put the speed things out. People will go faster in between stop signs,
right,
to make up for the fact that they have to stop every block or every other block.
Right. I think we need an editorial from Arne Duncan to tackle the root causes of why people drive fast. And we need to figure that out. The stresses of life. That's really what this is about.
I just want to wrap up by recommending something to watch. White Lotus, if you haven't seen it, on HBO. It's a 6-part TV series with Connie Britton and Steve Zahn and others. And it's about what happens to well-heeled people at a Hawaiian spa over the course of a week. It's not perfect, and I didn't love the ending, but it's really good. And I think the acting is terrific. Mike White just cranked this out for HBO in like no time. You watch it the same way you do Succession. It's almost fun to watch them be unhappy. I'm a big Connie Britton fan, and Zahn's great. I just think the whole cast is terrific.
Does it get better?
Jennifer Coolidge.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I watched 2 episodes and had to stop for a bit. Does it get better?
Well, it better hurry up if it doesn't.
I like slow moving dramas. I'm fine with that. But I left the first 2 episodes, and my husband and I looked at each other like, has anything happened yet?
Wait, you did or didn't like
the did? First we one? Watched 2 episodes and
then you were done.
I'll still watch it. He's done. I'll give it another.
Where are you on this, Austin?
I haven't watched the last episode, but I've watched all the rest of them. I love the pilot. It was one of the best pilot, the first episodes I've seen of anything in a while. And Jennifer Coolidge is amazing. Connie Britton's amazing. And I haven't watched a lot of Connie Britton stuff. I know her as, you know, Mrs. Coach Taylor from right. Friday Night Lights. And this is a completely different character that she plays equally in an equally compelling way, if not more so. Yeah, it's great.
I think the three teenagers in this show are fantastic too. Heather, you've seen it?
I have not, but I did once interview Connie Britton and her hair is amazing in person. So it is, you know,
as good as it is on TV, huh?
Yeah, it's truly one of the seven wonders of the world. And she was in a show called Nashville, where she played like a country music star. And that was, let me tell you, a bad show. It was not a good show. This is not a recommendation. I watched every episode that she was in simply because it was Connie Britton. So yes, I will be watching The White Lotus, if only for Connie Britton's hair.
I watched a lot of that show. I liked it when her daughter sang, at least. She wasn't a singer.
But, no.
her kids could in that show. Yes. Nashville.
But it was a bad show. I do not want to get emails about how I made people watch Nashville and they regret their life choices. I will not be held responsible for that.
Okay. She's feisty.
She
is quite feisty. I want a second. Between last week's program and this one's, I did watch the Paul McCartney special on Hulu, and I loved it. You guys recommended it. I got Johanna to watch it with me, and we loved it. So I would second that. As far as music goes, I would just ask people who haven't ever listened to Nancy Griffith to give her a listen. She died at age 68 last week. Just an amazing songwriter, amazing talent. And it was really a gut punch that she died. So Nancy Griffith is my recommendation this week.
That's Eric Zorn, John Hansen, Heather Sharon, Austin Berg. We're produced this week by Ashley Byhun. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Bye.
Miss this was fun. I miss you guys. Great.
Yeah.
Likewise.
We'll see you back.
Bye. Well,
we didn't get a chance to talk about Heather, the pharmacist Heather wrote about, who's faking
eBay. I saw the headline. I'm like, oh, he did it on the side. The dude's putting it on me.
Yeah, I know.
On eBay, he's got a return address sticker.
the fake vaccine, and it's like so obvious because those cards are so. They're so easy to counterfeit. So that was a very interesting story.
Yeah.
Heather covered it. So
I wrote it only because I knew it was going to do crazy traffic for us, and lo, it did. So
crazy traffic for us too. We all talked about it on the radio. Thank you, Heather. I'll send you $5.
There you go. See you, everybody.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.